Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 3rd of December. First hour of our program today, loneliness is the topic. Our guest has done a wide-ranging study of loneliness and has some extremely interesting findings. James Fowler is the author of Alone in the Crowd, The Structure and Spread of Loneliness in a Large Social Network. He's associate professor in the Center for Wireless and Population Health Systems at California Institute for Telecommunications and Information Technology and the Political Science Department at the University of California, San Diego. He's written a number of other books, Friendships, Moderate in an Association Between Dopamine, Gene Variant, and Political Ideology, Legislative Success in a Small World, Social Network Analysis and the Dynamics of Congressional Legislation. He's written extensively on this topic and has found the average person experiences loneliness about 48 days a year, but having a lonely friend can add 17 days of loneliness annually. By comparison, every additional friend can decrease loneliness by about 5%, which translates to about 2.5 fewer lonely days a year. What they did is look at, you're familiar, I'm sure, many of you, with the Framingham Heart Study, landmark work that has gone on for years and years. And the researchers worked with more than 5,100 participants who were the offspring of the original subjects of the landmark Framingham Heart Study. We're going to be welcoming your phone calls, as we always do, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join our conversation. Professor James Fowler, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
This is a time of year, I think, when we think more about loneliness, or at least we're more aware of people who might be lonely, do you think?
Yes, and it's interesting because it was almost a year ago today that we released our study on happiness. And so I do think that there's something about December that makes people feel a little emotional or be a little bit more in touch with their emotions.
Now, this was a huge study. I found it interesting that, tell me how it came about, looking at the offspring of the people who were in that famous heart study.
Right, so Nicholas Christakis and I started working together about 7 years ago now, and he's very interested in how health behavior spreads from person to person to person, and I was very interested in how political behavior spreads from person to person to person. And a mutual friend introduced us. Our story is a network story in and of itself, and the mutual friend realized when he talked to both of us independently that we were really working on the same problem, and that is, you know, what is it that binds us together in these beautiful social networks, and what is it that about these networks that really makes us human? And so when Nicholas and I got together, we thought that what we really needed to be able to study these questions is we needed a really good source of data. And so we started looking around, and we were at Harvard at the time, both of us, and the Framingham Heart Study is not too far from Harvard. It's right outside of Boston in the town of Framingham, Massachusetts. And we went to them and we started talking to them about our ideas about mapping the social networks of the participants of their study. And when we discovered that just in order to keep people in the study, keep them coming back year after year, that for over 30 years they had been asking people questions like, where do you live? Who are your family members? And most importantly, name a close friend. And so it was just fantastic. This data that we thought we were going to have to generate from scratch, they'd already been keeping, not for the purpose of research, but just in order to keep people coming back into the study.
So you had it there.
So we were able to turn that information into electronic information, and we were able to start to do these studies. And so the first study that came out was on the spread of obesity. The second one was on the spread of smoking behavior. Then last year we had a study on the spread of happiness, and now we have this study on the spread of loneliness.
How do you describe loneliness?
Well, loneliness, we measure this with a very, very technical instrument. We ask people, are you lonely? The way this question usually works is we ask people, during the past week, how many days during the past week have you felt lonely? And people will say somewhere between 0 and 7. And people come in for exams, you know, every 2 to 4 years or so, and so we can see how these feelings of loneliness change over time at the same time as their position in the network is changing.
Mm-hmm. And most people, the average person feels lonely how many days?
About 48 days a year.
That seems high, doesn't it?
Well, it's 48 is a big number. Another way to describe it is that people feel lonely about 8/10 of a day per week. That probably sounds small. 48 sounds large. It just sort of depends on the framing. But I do think that in that average are people who just feel lonely all the time. I think that a lot of us who are well connected to our networks, that we don't realize that there are people on the edges of these networks that really for whom loneliness is a severe problem.
Mm-hmm. So tell me how we get from one person being lonely to that person's friend, and then the friend of the person who's friend of the lonely person is also lonely.
Right. So we looked at this network, and in this network, we were able to see whether or not two people who were friends tended to get lonely in sequence. So one person got lonely and the next person got lonely. And because we had a fully connected network, we had these beautiful maps of the whole network, and they're colored by who's lonely and who's not. And we were able to see over time not just what happens between friends, but between friends of friends and between friends of friends of friends. And what we found was astonishing. People think of loneliness as something that you experience when you don't have any friends, but it's not true. You can be at the center of your network and still look around and not feel necessarily well connected. And so as a consequence, these feelings can be transmitted between friends. In fact, we found evidence that these clusters of loneliness in the network extend up to 3 degrees of separation. What that means is that if I don't know anything else about you, but I know that your friend's friend feels lonely, then I can do better than chance at predicting whether or not you'll feel lonely yourself.
And how can that happen? How does that happen?
Right. So another co-author in our study, John Cacioppo, has studied loneliness extensively. And we think that what's going on here, although we can't be sure because all we really know is whether or not people are lonely in this particular study. But in other studies, what loneliness does is it has a huge effect on our health. It actually impacts how our heart works. It impacts our longevity, our mortality, our morbidity, and it also impacts our emotional state. And so we come to feel a little bit more negative about our friends. We come to feel a little bit less trusting of our friends when we feel lonely, which is ironic because the feeling of loneliness itself is about this disconnection. And so that when you do interact with other people, when you're in this state, you tend to transmit negative feelings. And as a consequence, those negative feelings can then encourage loneliness in the other person.
So you say that what we need to do, rather than be indifferent to this, is we need to reach out to people, to people even in our family, to lonely loved ones, rather than withdraw themselves.
Yes, that's definitely true. It's true that connections to family members and friends alike can help. But one of the interesting results in the study was that loneliness doesn't spread between family members. It only spreads between the connections that we choose, so between friends, between spouses, and between next-door neighbors. And so the idea here is that apparently we're not very well soothed by the connections that were given to us, and we're more soothed by these optional connections where we feel like people have a choice about whether or not they maintain a relationship with us.
Oh, that's interesting. Did you find, James, we talked about the month of December, what about, we were talking about this at the dinner table the other night, that you begin, we were talking about polar bears, actually, and people hibernating for the winter. And it seems to me as though we do that. You don't see your neighbors sometimes for months. We're entering that time of year. It's snowing and you might see them shoveling, but we're not outside having those great chats that you have. Do you find that the loneliness tends to happen partially because of weather, isolation, et cetera, right now, that this, in addition to the holidays and feeling as though you're not connected when everybody's supposed to be connected, it's also associated with the weather?
We did find a hint of this in the data, that there's a seasonal variation to this, so that people in the winter were more likely to feel lonely than people in the summer. But we couldn't tell whether or not that was just due to random chance or whether that was actually something we're confident is there in the data. I think that we would need to have a lot more information to be able to say that for sure. But we do know that compared to the size of the effects for what happens to you when your friend starts feeling lonelier, the seasonal variation really isn't very large.
Why do women appear to be more vulnerable than men to catching loneliness?
So this is a touchy subject, right? Because what I have to do now is I have to say something about the average woman and not about all women. But what studies show is that on average, women tend to be more sensitive to the emotions of other people. And they also tend to have slightly more empathy. And so what this means is that if you're feeling lonely and you're broadcasting, you know, these negative emotions to other people, the women in your circle are more likely to pick up on those emotions than men are, on average. And I just want to emphasize that on average point, because I think everybody can think of counterexamples of women who are completely insensitive and men who are very touchy-feely. And I think that if we had a measure for how sensitive people were to emotions, then this result of women versus men would actually go away.
Hmm. So that also means that women, even though they've caught the loneliness, are more likely to address the issue and to engage the person who was initially lonely?
I'm not sure that they're more likely to solve the problem, but they certainly are more likely to experience the problem because we found that the rates of transmission were stronger from women and to women than they were from men or to men.
Mm-hmm. And tell me, Professor Fowler, you mentioned this, the mental and physical diseases that may be associated with loneliness that can shorten a life or certainly make a life more difficult. What are those?
So there are a number of different studies that associate, not just in humans but in animals, decreased function in the body of different organs and also increased risk for certain disease outcomes. And so loneliness has been associated with obesity. It's been associated with poor cardiac function. It's been associated with certain kinds of increase in risk of death and increased risk of mortality, given different kinds of stress that people are under in a wide variety of different studies.
Do you ever get lonely?
I do feel lonely sometimes, and I guess another interesting thing about this study, you know, we've done a lot of these studies, and we talk about them in our book, Connected, but what's really interesting about this particular study is that loneliness is a feeling about the network itself, and so you first of all, it wasn't obvious that the people who would feel lonely would be the people at the edges, but this is exactly what we found. And the interesting thing is that we found this poor gets poorer dynamic in the network. The people at the edges of the network are more likely to feel lonely, and they're also spreading that loneliness to other people, and they're also losing ties in the future as a result of feeling lonely. And so you get this picture of the whole network, like a crocheted sweater with yarns at the edge that are becoming frayed. And the idea is that if one of these yarns comes detached, it can start to unravel the whole network. And it really, I think, raises the stakes here for mental health providers, because what it suggests is that when we protect those people at the edges, when we help them to reconnect to their networks, we're really helping everybody in the network.
Mm. So it affects the whole community.
Absolutely.
Huh. And how do you help people reconnect to their network?
I think that one of the things that we find mental health providers doing is we find them, you know, recommending that their patients spend time with their families and spend time with their friends. This is something that I think is getting a little easier to do these days because electronic communication has made it easier to stay in touch with people even if they've, say, moved away. One of the interesting things in our study, because it took place from 1973 to 2003, is that what we tend to find is that emotions spread to people that are physically close. And so your friends who live hundreds of miles away don't necessarily have an impact on you, but your friends who live nearby do. And I think that the reason why we found that result is because these are the friends that we had a lot of exposure to, people that we spent time with. Well, now with things like Facebook, you can stay in touch with friends even if they move to a different city. And it'll be very interesting going forward to see if this effective distance goes away, because now it's much easier, I think, for us to spread emotions online than it was, say, 10 years ago. And certainly, you know, before the internet existed, you could spread emotions on the telephone by talking to people or whatever, but I think that we're really in a state that we're hyper-connected now, as we talk about in our book, Connected.
Right. I've fairly recently discovered Facebook, and I love it. Yeah, I really do, because I am, just as you said, connected with people I knew years and years ago. And you can get a little bit too much of it. You can play around with it a little too much. But the connection of it is just incredible, I think.
Yeah, no, it's certainly, I think it's one of the reasons why people are so interested in social networks now. But the interesting thing about it is that we've lived in social networks for hundreds of thousands of years. You know, we've always had friends, we've always had family, and we have these patterns of connection that exist not just now in the real world, but have really existed ever since we became human. And so one of the things we talk about in our book, Connected, is that these networks are really in our nature. And to really understand something like the spread of emotions online or of loneliness online, you first really need to understand what's going on in these real human social networks.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest is Professor James Fowler, Associate Professor in the Center for Wireless and Population Health Systems at California Institute for Telecommunications and Information Technology and the Political Science Department at the University of California. He is the author of Connected, The Surprising Power of Our Social Networks and How They Shape Our Lives, and is author of a massive study on loneliness, interviewing some 5,100 people following. These were the offspring of people who were in the Framingham Heart Study, so they had well-documented information about where people are, how many friends they have, how connected they feel, how their health, obviously it's a health study, so how their hearts have been doing, and what about weight, et cetera. We welcome your phone calls as we talk about loneliness. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And I guess the obvious question here is, do you feel lonely? Do you feel lonely a good portion of the year or at some times of the year? Do you understand what he's talking about, that you can even be the friend of a friend, the 3 degrees of separation, so that the loneliness of your friend's friend may indeed influence you in some way and make you lonely, and what it does to community to have a lot of people lonely, and how we get people to reconnect. So call us, okay? Our number, 800-486-8655. And we do want to tell you, too, because next hour is going to be something we don't ordinarily do. We have specific questions for the next hour, maybe motivated by this desire to give meaningful gifts during the holiday season. So we're asking you if you want to think about it some, because nobody responded to my Facebook request. We are on Facebook. If you want to go to Facebook and think about the question of the best gift that you ever gave and the best gift that you ever received, and maybe we'll get some really wonderful ideas, all of us, for what we may want to think about giving. All right, we'll go to your phone calls in just one moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now for Professor James Fowler, starting with Charlene from Cumberland. Hi, Charlene.
Good morning.
Hi.
I would like to just make a comment. I have a background of long-term care, which is skilled facilities for the senior population. And I would like to tell you just how valuable and how important social connections are. It seems when people come into nursing homes or assisted living, they lose that connection. And that is one of the first things that we see is the depression and the not eating and the loneliness. And we work so diligently to keep the families connected, to keep the friends, the guys from the local VFW hall connected. And so I think this is just a wonderful topic to discuss.
Hmm. And how do you keep them connected, Charlene? What do you do?
Well, it's difficult. There is that stigma of once a person goes into a facility that they're no longer a person. And so you have to go out there. You have to keep those connections. You call. You invite the gentleman in to have their meetings at your facility. You connect. You try to get out to the fish fries on Friday nights. You get those families to still come in and to bring all the other siblings in to continue that social networking. But it's difficult, and it's very, very sad on how many friends and families do not stay connected.
Mm-hmm. Professor Fowler.
Let me just echo this concern that it's very difficult to intervene in these social networks. Lisa Berkman has been studying the effect of social support on health for over 30 years now, I think. And she has specifically found a lot of those same kinds of things that we're finding here, which is that when you look at across time, you find that the people who feel these emotions are also at risk of a lot of different health outcomes that aren't great. But that whenever you go in and you try to experimentally intervene in these networks, it's very, very hard to show the effects. And I think the reason why is because we really have this natural variation in the tendency to connect other people. In fact, one of the things we talk about in our book, Connected, is that we have done twin studies that show that some of the positions that we have in our networks are actually influenced by our genes. So some of this is under our control, where we're able to go and make friends with people and alter our social networks. But we all have these, I think, personalities that make it hard to move us in one direction or another.
Anything else?
I'm in agreement with that.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I think, too, sometimes that people get diagnosed with true depression, they call it, and all these other different dementias and things like that, when all that it is loneliness, is that they need to be remaining connected. It could be with letters and phone calls and simple visits. But I think sometimes doctors are so quick to diagnose, well, they are depressed, when sometimes it's just loneliness.
I completely agree with that. And in fact, the question that we use to assess loneliness is part of a set of questions that are used to diagnose depression. But if you look at those two things, they don't perfectly correspond. And so it's often the case that depressed people feel lonely, and it's often the case that lonely people feel depressed. But there are some people who experience one and not the other. And so I think it's really important to remember that there aren't one-size-fits-all solutions to both problems.
Thank you very much, Charlene, for your call. We go to Ruthie from Milwaukee next. Hello, Ruthie.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I am wondering how this occurs and what the remedy might be. Baby boomers, many of us came from very, very large families, so we had lots of siblings, and it seemed like there was never any loneliness because the siblings brought friends into the family and all of that. Well, now we're older, and people have all gone their separate ways, and our parents are alone, and everybody has a different opinion about how much they want to be involved in any kind of a family event. And then that kind of transfers over into the work environment where, you can't participate, or there are reasons why you can't participate in any kind of a work-related function because there's parents to take care of. And I find myself in a situation where I would say I'm one of those people that's lonely every single day, even though I might be surrounded by people. Which leads to depression. And talking with doctors and social workers, they do they categorize that as depression as a result of, a family environment or situational. And I don't see any remedy for that when you are over 60 years old and everybody has sort of, gone their own ways. And I don't know, it feels like there's nobody left.
Do you live by yourself, Ruthie? Do you have family?
I live alone.
Mm-hmm.
And even, our children have all grown up and gone away.
Right.
And so there is no, there is no Christmas. Because everybody's gone.
They wouldn't come home for Christmas, or don't you have a place to go for Christmas?
The only place that anybody would go would be to visit my parents, but we're no longer, people don't feel like they're brothers and sisters anymore because they've all gone their separate ways.
Oh.
And our children, the cousins, because of all the families splitting apart, the cousins don't get together. And so the only way that people seem to make friends is if they've gone away to college and they've set up their own, you know, the younger people have set up their own support system of friends. But those of us who are older, their parents, we just are twisting in the wind.
Yeah. Don't go away. I want Professor Fowler to speak to you as well. Professor Fowler.
So this is another thing that we find in the study and in all these other studies of health effects, that loneliness certainly on average increases as people age. And this is because you're going to naturally just lose some ties over time from people moving away or when you get towards the end of life from people passing away. So ideally what you'd want to be able to do then is to create new friends, create new connections. But that gets harder and harder to do as people get older. One thing that I would recommend, I'm not a mental health provider, but one thing that I would recommend is it seems like people are better able to make friends whenever they join organizations that are doing things that they care about. And so I'll just talk about my own dad. He retired and he wasn't really sure what to do and he was seeming like he was feeling a little lonely, and he joined a group of master gardeners, and through his love of gardening and that organization, he was able to create new friendships, even though he's well into his 60s now. I don't know, I as a scientist, I don't know whether or not that works, but as you know, as a son, I'm pretty sure that helped him a lot, and it could help other people.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes you do have to do that, right? You just have to create something new for yourself, and it is much harder when you're older.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And I think that as the population ages and more people are connecting with one another online, that could potentially help solve this problem as well. I think it's hard to get someone in their 60s or 70s or 80s to start using Facebook, although there are people that increasingly age is not so relevant for Facebook. But as the people who are currently on Facebook get older, I wonder if it's going to be easier for them to avoid loneliness because they're able to stay in touch with people who move away and they're able to maintain these connections online.
What about her point? I'm wondering if she's saying something that we need to pay attention to. Obviously, everybody in the family, some people must care about some people in the family. I'm wondering about what has happened to all of us in the past 20 years or so is that the network or your family group is scattered all over the country, sometimes all over the world. So it's very hard to keep in touch with family. Does your study point to the fact that maybe that group needs to return to someplace and be together, or at least those people who enjoy each other, that foundation is important, brief as it may be, to keep us from being lonely?
Well, our study, because we find that the effects are local, right? So it's, in our study, it was the friends who lived nearby that had the biggest effect, or the your spouse or your next door neighbor, but not the other neighbors on your friend. What that suggests is it's frequency of contact that really matters. Mm. But this study only goes up to 2003. It's before we had this internet revolution where we were able to take our social networks online. So I'm just really hopeful that this online contact is going to be something that we're going to be able to use to substitute for this face-to-face contact and at least a little bit as we go forward.
Thanks, Ruthie, very much for your call. Barbara is next from, oh, dear, I'm sorry, Barbara. Call back, please. I hit two buttons at the same time. I'm sorry.
You disconnected.
Yeah, I did. John, I'm so sorry to do that on this show of all shows. Please call back. John from Eau Claire. Hi, John.
Hi. I was just wondering if you studied pets in the study at all, and how, whether that's good or bad, if people rely on pets for friends.
Yeah, in our study, we don't know whether or not people had pets. There are other studies that suggest that pets are good for emotional well-being for older people. And there's also one study that suggests that you get this contagion in animal-human networks as well. And so people who gain weight their pets also tend to gain weight. And so this was echoing our earlier study on the spread of obesity in social networks. I'm not sure how you would measure loneliness in a dog, but there certainly is evidence that these pets, later in life especially, are good for our emotions.
Hmm. Do you have one, John?
Yes, I have three cats.
You have three cats.
And a dog that is gone, but I dearly miss him.
Oh, it's time for another dog, John. I think they take care of loneliness in large order. I can remember living by myself for years, and it might be kind of wacky, but my dog became almost my little daughter. You know, I love that dog, and she got me through some rough times, rough years. She was a buddy. That can happen with animals.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call. Jackie is next from Brookfield. Hello, Jackie.
Hi. I was calling largely in response to the last caller. I think it was the last caller. And, you know, I'm one of those. My husband and I are a couple who have no family nearby. My husband has only one sister, and both of his parents have passed away. And I am not geographically or emotionally close to my family. And the church where we belong is not one of those places where, you know, you go and sit in pews and because you're afraid to, you know, you want to stay out of hell or you're afraid of hell or something like that. And so there are, you know, there are communities that the three principles that we live by are connect the disconnected. And people can be disconnected in a lot of different ways. Live our lives together and give ourselves away. And so a lot of times, you know, if you can find a community like that where people are joining together to make a difference in other people's lives, you know, our food pantry, you know, just different things like that, it can really develop some positive, meaningful relationships. We always have our, you know, all the other people that we know who don't have any family nearby. We have them for all the holidays and, you know, just, it's a good community.
Yes, it sounds wonderful.
Yeah, let me just jump in here and say that, you know, those three principles by which you live, they're universal. Right, so the one of the things that makes human beings special is not just our capacity to live with one another in these large groups, but it's also our tendency towards altruism. So more than so than any other species, we're willing to pay a personal cost to help someone else, you know, have something better, even if we don't know that person. Scientists have studied this for a long time as a puzzle, because if you're giving everything away to someone else, then how on earth are you going to survive, or how on earth are your children going to survive? And so over the course of, you know, hundreds of thousands of years, how is it that we're still altruistic after all that time? And one of the things that we talk about in our book, Connected, is that it's possible that these networks and altruism co-evolved, because the idea is that networks promote the spread of good things. If they didn't promote the spread of good things, then they would cease to exist. If someone that you know does something bad to you, what do? Do you increase contact with them? No, usually you cut the tie. And so the fact that these networks exist and then that we continue to live in them is part and parcel of this tendency, this natural human tendency to give to other people.
Hmm. And it's interesting, I'm sure you're very aware of the longevity studies, those studies of people who live to be 100 years old all over the world. They've pinpointed places, and certainly this having a community that has a spiritual element to it helps people live a long time.
Yes, I think that the studies, though, in general, my read of it is that it's the community more than the spiritual. Mm. Because you can have variation in, you know, even natural variation in how spiritual people feel. This is something else that's influenced not just by our environment, but also by our biology. And it really seems that it's this capacity to connect and this ability to have a ready-made group at your disposal for social support when times are tough that can really help you in the long run.
Yeah. Thank you, Jackie, so much for your call. Barbara from Milwaukee. Hello, Barbara. Thanks for reconnecting.
Yeah, well, apparently I'm good at that, because one of the reasons I'm calling, and I talked with your screener about this, and he felt the same way, that I don't think I'm ever really lonely. And when I heard 48 times or 48 days a year, that's incredible to me. And I know people whom I have helped who suffered with terrible feelings of loneliness. I'm a relatively independent person. I have friends, and sometimes I think I'm more married to my friends than couples I know who are married, but I'm a single person. I live alone. I work by myself. I'm self-employed. I have friends. I volunteer at many places. I'm connected in many ways, but I'm perfectly fine with being by myself, and I'm wondering if you have any information on that in your studies.
Yes, yeah, so another thing we talk about in our book is a study that John Cacioppo did with some behavior geneticists that there's actually two different studies, one on adults and one on children, and both of those studies suggest that loneliness, this feeling, is about half nature and half nurture. There's some people who are more disposed to feeling lonely than other people, and so if you feel like you just sort of naturally don't feel this, then that's great. You're one of the lucky ones. It's also important to remember that this 48 days a year number, another way of thinking about that is that could also mean that 6 out of 7 people don't feel much loneliness at all, but 1 out of 7 people feels loneliness all the time. And so, you know, it's really important to remember that, you know, when we talk about, you know, these averages, the average person, you know, does something, it's hiding a lot of variation from person to person in those numbers.
Thank you very much, Barbara.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Sally from Middleton. Hi.
Hi. Well, hi. I'm a twin of Barbara, because I couldn't believe this. I do now, and I think what your guest is saying is he's obviously made a very sound investigation, he and his group, and I'm sure it's going to be helpful, but maybe it's because I live right outside of Madison in Middleton, Wisconsin, but there are more things going on. I'm 77, and I can't keep up with all the things that I'd love to go to and be a part of. It's just that I think, oh, I've just got to stay home for a while and catch up, because there's just so many things. If you're retired in particular, you don't have the constrictions of work and other duties, and I just love it. I was in Middleton, has a senior center, and I think a lot of places do, and I happened to drop by for some other thing. They had a huge room plus another ordinary size room full of people, men and women, a little more women, playing cards, and they could choose either sheep's head or bridge. And they looked like they were having a great time, and that it's a weekly function.
Well, this is exactly one of the points that we're making. You have this poor gets poorer dynamic at the edge of networks, where people who feel lonely, they're likely to cut ties in the future, and the people who have few ties are likely to feel lonelier in the future. But there's also a rich gets richer dynamic that's on the other side of that, so that if you can just get on the, you know, to the tipping point, right, where you start to join a group, or you start to be connected to other people, then they want to connect you to other people. They might introduce you to other organizations, and pretty soon it's possible that we could, you know, help one of these people who feel lonely to be exactly in your situation, where, you know, you don't feel lonely, you actually need a break from all the social activity. And so, you know, it would be great if we could, you know, figure out ways to help people at the edges of the network to become more like you.
Thank you, Sally. And you can hear that enthusiasm in Sally's voice, right?
Oh, absolutely.
She's sparkling. More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Professor James Fowler, Associate Professor in the Center for Wireless and Population Health Systems at California Institute for Telecommunications and Information Technology and the Political Science Department at the University of California, San Diego. Co-author of Connected, The Surprising Power of Our Social Networks and How They Shape Our Lives, and also one of the people who put together this remarkable study on loneliness, in which they looked at offspring of people in the Framingham Heart Study, 5,124 people, I think, and found that there are 3 degrees of separation for loneliness. So if you feel lonely, your friend will feel lonely, and the friend's friend will also feel the effects of your loneliness. So what do we do about all that? And what does it do to our society? Our social networks may become unraveled because of this, because it affects so many people. And what does it say about how we reach out. More phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, we're going to be talking about the best gift you ever gave and the best gift you ever received. It's a wonderful public radio audience, and I figured that we'd get some lovely suggestions for giving during the holiday season. And if you'd like to, which would be nice, you could go to the social network Facebook. If you go to WPR.org, and then you go to Kathleen Dunn, and it says Facebook. There's a little thing there for Facebook. This would be nice to do if you go and include. You don't have to call in necessarily. I've asked people in the office here to talk about their gifts as well. So John Treader will be talking to you, Rhonda Fanning, Lisa Nalbandian is going to come in, our regional manager, to talk about what they've given and received. And if we got a list of them, wouldn't that be a nice thing? So if you want to go to our Facebook page and do that, we can share some of those as well on our second hour conversation. All right, let's go back to phone calls for Professor James Fowler. Ruth, we have some open lines, 800-486-8655. Ruth from Waukesha, hello.
Hi. Hi. Kathleen and your guest. I just want to thank you for having this topic because I think it's so important. And as I've been sitting on the line here waiting for my turn, my heart has just been beating and beating because it is a highly emotional issue as well.
Mm.
When I was living out west for a while, I had some depression, and I was living in a community, at a religious community there, and I got depression, and I went to one of the older women in the community, and I told her about it, and she said, if you want to cheer yourself up, go and talk to Dr. Mason. And so I did, and this was this elderly gentleman who was a retired minister living in his own home by himself. His wife had been put in a nursing home. He was blind and almost blind, losing his sight, and yet his attitude was absolutely fabulous. And she said, just go see him. So I did, and I found that I could do some things for him to help him, and it just picked me up tremendously. And that was a good experience for me to go forward with. However, presently in my life, I've had so many losses, and I reverted back to this, oh, I'll give something to somebody else and pick myself up in that way. But I have found that if my own bucket is so very empty, it's very hard for me to give genuinely with a good feeling afterwards. I almost feel drained in the process of trying to pick myself up, you know, by giving to someone else. And so that's just a comment that I wanted to make.
Might be time for somebody to be giving to you right now, Ruth.
Huh? Amen. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks so much for the call, Professor Fowler.
This is something that a lot of times people hear our studies of social networks and they think that there's nothing that they can do. And so there are things that happen to them in their lives. People pass away. Those are obviously going to affect how lonely you feel. And our book sort of adds insult to injury, perhaps, in that it's not just what happens to you, but it's what happens to your friends that can ripple through the network and also affect you. The point that we always make, we try to make this very firmly at the end of our book, is that while you might be influenced by these dozens or hundreds or thousands of other people in the social network and everything that's happening to them, you also have an opportunity to shape their lives. If you tell someone that they can influence just one person, I think they're going to take less responsibility for their life than if you tell them that they influence 1,000. And so having this fundamental change in the way we see the world, I think really helps us to be able to take control of what we are able to control and are able to really convert these ideas about social networks into social action and into a personal improvement in our own lives. And I think that's why giving to others is so important, because really what you're doing is you're initiating that cascade of positive things that can spread in a network.
What about asking somebody to pay a little attention to you at this point? And what about Ruth? She called a radio station, you know, maybe a friend heard her, or just saying to somebody, I'm kind of down here. I need to have a cup of coffee. I need to be with you. I need to talk.
Oh, this is absolutely a two-way street. And, you know, part of having a connection with somebody is not just, give, give, give. It's mutual.
Right.
And so, you know, one of the things I had a friend write me, and I'm obviously very positive about social connections, but not every social connection is positive. And my friend has experienced some difficulties with an abusive family member, and so I you know, it's important to point out that there's a caveat that there are some people that we connect to, and they don't really connect back to us. And if that's the case, then you know maybe that's not necessarily a healthy relationship. But what you really want to be able to do is you want to connect to people who you can give and give and give to, and when it's your turn, then they can help to give something back to you to help you make it to the next day as well.
Right. Thank you, Ruth, so much for your call. Marianne is next from Madison. Hi, Marianne.
Hi.
Hi.
I am just so thrilled to be able to tell you about this thing. I discovered Senior Connections, which happens to be at 11:30 on Thursday, so I'm sort of getting ready to go. They always have a great lunch. They have between 70 and 80 people, and it is socializing and caring and sharing and helping other people also, so you feel quite useful. Food pantry they have, and today they'll be wrapping packages to give out. All kinds of things going on there. And we seniors just love it.
I can tell.
I look forward to it every Thursday. And it's just a great way to connect. It's called Senior Connections. Happens to be on Sherman Avenue at St. Paul Church in the basement. And the pastor's wife is a fabulous cook.
That's even better. If you were closer, I'd be over.
But I wonder, there may be other places, you know, that have senior connections. I don't know, but I just feel so fortunate last year to have found this.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like we need a lot of those, Professor Fowler.
No, it does. And I think that, you know, people already have this intuition that's what really, really helps, is to be able to provide an opportunity for people to connect with one another in exactly that kind of setting.
Thank you so much, Marianne. Have a really good time today. I think you probably will. Chris from Green Bay is next. Hi, Chris.
Hi, it's nice to talk with you. I'm calling to talk about my dad, who is 82. We lost our mom a year ago, but what's made all the difference for my dad is that 4 years ago, my parents moved out of the family home and into an apartment complex. And in every building, there's an ambassador, and my dad is the ambassador for his building. And he plans a monthly social event. That's his job. He puts out a newsletter once a week. But the people in the building see each other every day. So when I think about my dad being by himself, if he had stayed in the house, he would really have been in a neighborhood where he didn't know anybody anymore, compared to this apartment building where he has made all these 50 new friends.
Wonderful.
And he feels so connected. And he doesn't, I know he has only moments, but he's basically a pretty happy person. So sometimes changing your setting can help a lot, and it's not easy for an older person to make that kind of a change, but he's done it, and he's been successful.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to share that.
Oh, I'm so glad. That's great. Professor Fowler.
Yeah, one of the ironies of modern life is that we've become more disconnected as we've become more mobile. And so you really don't have these cohesive neighborhoods on average that we had, you know, say 50 years ago, because people's friends are scattered all over. And I actually lived in one of these neighborhoods where unfortunately, you know, despite my attempts to be otherwise, it was the kind of neighborhood where, you know, people come in, they hit their garage door opener, they put their car in the garage and they close it, and they don't really talk that much to each other. And I was miserable. I hated living in that neighborhood. And then we moved to a neighborhood where we don't have those kinds of garages, and where we talk to each other. And we have a social for the neighborhood, and everyone comes out and catches up with people that we haven't necessarily had much contact with, and those things can really make a difference. So that for older people, I think sometimes we think that, you know, putting them in an assisted living condition or putting them in a condition where they're with other older people, in some ways I think there's a kind of a negative perception of that. But if you put them into situations like the one the caller just described, where they're able to connect to other people, that's often going to be better than their average life now in a modern neighborhood. And so I really think that maybe our ideas about, you know, these sort of senior living arrangements are going to change over the next few years as we come to realize how important it is for them to be able to connect to other people.
Sometimes it's hard to get people convinced to make that. I think it's you get used to what you have, right?
But that's exactly right.
Well, we're out of time. Thank you. This was really a wonderful hour. Thank you so much for being with us and doing this study. It opened up a whole new area of conversation for us, Professor Fowler.
Thank you very much. And if people want more information, they can go to connectedthebook.com.
Oh, say that again. Connected?
Connectedthebook.com.
Connected the book altogether?
Yes. .com.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Professor James Fowler is Associate Professor in the Center for Wireless and Population Health Systems at California Institute for Telecommunications and Information Technology and the Political Science Department at the University of California. The book is Connected, The Surprising Power of Our Social Networks and How They Shape Our Lives. ConnectedTheBook.com is where you can get more information. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. There were some wonderful calls today, some memorable ones. Next hour, we'll be talking about giving and receiving. So we're going to ask you to participate in that. That's all coming up in just a few moments here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.